Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the first week of May. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today my guests are Scott and Susan Freeman. Together, Scott and Susan recently published a wonderful book entitled Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. Today, I have the honor to talk with them about their experiences, their philosophy, and the wisdom they have gained from living with the land. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So a little hint. These birds have just begun to come back to the Pacific Northwest after wintering in the warmer southern climes. Some will stay around and breed, while others will continue moving north to breed in the Yukon. And with Charlie Fleischman's help, Charlie, of course, is our wonderful sound engineer, let's have a quick look at observations and news from around our area.
On April 14th, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center hosted a bio blitz to observe and count living creatures in and around Port Townsend. A total of 35 observers reported over 700 different observations and 178 species of plants and animals. Wendy Feltham, a good friend of Nature Now, was the top identifier based on number of species observed. The list of the top five species observed was interesting. Not too surprisingly, the top four were plants: Oregon grape, miner's lettuce, red flowering currant, and Arctic butterbur. The fifth most common species was the weird little sea creature by the wind sailors, or Velella. Every now and again, these strange relatives of the jellyfish wash up on shore by the hundreds. Their name comes from the upright fin or sail that catches the wind that propels them across the oceans. When alive, these little animals are a vibrant blue-green. Dead ones on the shore lose their color and become transparent and stiff.
A group of leaders of the Natural History Society spent several days last week exploring the woods and beaches near La Push on the outer coast. I was fortunate enough to go along. The list of plants and animals observed was very long. Out near Hole in the Wall, which is at Rialto Beach, we saw both pelagic and attached gooseneck barnacles, pelagic cormorants with their bright white flank patches contrasting with the deep black and metallic green bodies, and we saw a few hopeful signs of recovering ochre star populations. One of the highlights was to watch the spouting gray whales feeding off the mouth of the Quileut River, and on the last day to see a huge gray whale near shore in very shallow water, maybe 50 feet at most from the shore. It was feeding by sifting through the mud and the sand, and it was lying on its side with its mouth open, stirring up the sediment. That's how the gray whales feed. We even saw his or her pectoral fin, sticking out above the water.
Jeff Gibson reported on the Admiralty Audubon Sightings website that while out on the Marine Science Center Pier in Fort Worden, he watched eight turkey vultures circle high in the sky. At times, they were joined by a peregrine falcon, also soaring. Then Jeff saw a very large bird coming in from the northeast with what he presumed was a crow on its tail. As the big bird got closer, he realized it was a golden eagle with a raven bugging it. Jeff clearly saw the eagle's gold nape.
And last Saturday, participants in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Protection Island trip, it was aboard the Puget Sound Express, were treated to sights of many migrating and resident birds. Highlights were spotting rhinoceros auklets, large flocks of black brants getting ready for their migration north to the Arctic, common and red-necked loons, and a really spectacular tufted puffin that got very close to the boat and seemed to enjoy showing off for the folks. So let me introduce today's guests, Scott Freeman and Susan Leopold Freeman. Scott teaches biology at the University of Washington with a passion for helping students learn in new and active ways. Susan Leopold Freeman is a musician, illustrator, and granddaughter of the esteemed Otto Leopold, considered by many as the father of conservation. In 2004, the Freemans bought 18 acres of land along Tarboo Creek and began reforestation and salmon stream restoration work in conjunction with the Northwest Watershed Institute and the Jefferson Land Trust. Susan and Scott live by sort of holistic land ethic so profoundly put forth by Otto Leopold. I recently read the book written by our two guests. It's entitled Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. I found the story compelling, full of hope, and good science. And the book was more than autobiographical, and it was more than a story of hard work and encouraging results, and it was more than insights into the natural world around us. It is a beautiful and philosophical book. So welcome, Scott and Susan.
Great to be here, Nan. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Just to start off a little bit, tell me a bit about what inspired you to write the book and what basic story were you wanting to tell?
Well, the basic story goes back a long way when Susan and I first met at the Otto Leopold Reserve, as a matter of fact, where her grandfather started the project you alluded to a second ago. And we had always dreamed of doing a restoration project like her grandfather and her aunts and uncles and her dad had done back in the 1930s on our own. And when life brought us out to the Pacific Northwest in 2004, we started looking for a project, and that's when we found Tarboo Creek.
The book tells the story of your engagement at Tarboo Creek?
It does. Part of the book is about what we were doing as a family and, as it turned out, as a much larger community to work on this watershed, sort of as an example of what now people call community-based conservation could accomplish. But I also wanted the book to be, and for Susan, for her illustrations, to be about the spirit of why we were doing this, both for ourselves and for the larger community.
Mm-hmm. Before we go too much further in by way of introduction, Scott, let me ask you, and I'll ask Susan the same question. If there's one thing that you want Nature Now listeners to know about you, what would that be?
I'd say about our work on the creek and the work we've done as a family and with the larger community, I'd say the important things we do in life come from the heart. They're things we really love to do and love to leave a legacy for the future. And that, to me, is what we've tried to embody in this book and the project at Tarboo Creek.
That's beautiful. And Susan, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think doing this project and doing work on the land, the thing that has meant the most to me is just being outside and being part of a group and just with our family of doing something that makes the world better. And I think that has given me so much strength and stability of my life that something that I wish that other people could see and do for themselves too.
And well, we've both talked about a little bit about anyway, your grandfather, Otto Leopold. I'm wondering if one of you could sort of convey the essence of his concept of land ethic or wildlife ethic, just for those who might not be familiar with Otto Leopold's work.
He bought an old worn-out farm in Wisconsin, and the former owners had cut down most of the trees and plowed up the prairie and planted corn, and then that failed and walked away from this farm, and that's when my grandfather bought the farm. And I think it was kind of a shock to his family when he came home and said that he had bought this farm, and it turns out this derelict piece of land. But I think what he was sort of starting to envision with his property is what can be done with the land. And I think as he worked the land and tried to restore and plant trees and replant the prairie and bringing his family back to work on it, he started to think of what man's relationship is to the land, and not only recording what they were doing there, but why they were doing it, and the idea of bringing back the land to what it once was, or what we now call ecological restoration, is something that he kind of pioneered. And his idea was land was not a possession that you would take for your own benefit and use however you want, but actually you want to have some kind of respect and nurture your relationship with the land just the way you would with another person.
I sort of remember a quote having read Sand County Almanac decades and decades ago, and I'm not sure if the quote was even from there, but it was something about something is right when it preserves or restores the integrity and the stability and the beauty of the ecosystem, and it's wrong when it does otherwise. And I thought, how simple is that? Probably simpler to say than actually to do, which now brings me back to your project. I think we know a little bit about the sort of basic goal when you started it. Tell me more about why you wanted to work on restoring this piece of land.
There's several layers to the answer. Part of it, we just wanted to do as a family, that this is something working together. Word common purpose is something that just bonds people together. And probably the most surprising thing about this project has been that it grew way beyond that, between a project that was sort of Susan and my vision or even our immediate family, and even beyond friends and immediate acquaintances who were part of our world already, into a much larger community that got involved in the Tarbell Creek watershed. My favorite quote from Otto Leopold is, he said that two things interest him: the relation of people to each other and the relation of people to the land. And I think the reason that we keep going out there and keep doing this stooped labor is because this project is feeding us on both levels, our relation to each other, the people around us, and our relation to the land. And to see it get better over time is one of the most rewarding, actually both things, our relationship with the people around us and the relation to the land is one of the most rewarding things I can imagine experiencing in life.
Well, let me take you back to those sort of first days, months, and years. How did you start? What was the first thing you did, and how did you figure out how to do it?
Well, we were kind of lucky. When we thought we wanted to do some kind of restoration project, we contacted different land trusts, and Jefferson Land Trust was one of the few that got back to us. We said we were looking for some property, and they actually had just been contacted by Peter Bales at the Northwest Watershed Institute, who was looking for a conservation buyer. They connected the two of us, and that's how we ended up buying the property.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter Bales actually had the grant to re-meander the stream, and that had to be done the summer that we bought the property. So he was under a timeline. So that was actually something that he had organized and had ready to go. So when we bought the property, it was kind of like, okay, here we go. A couple months later, they were out there with the excavators starting to re-meander the creek.
What's involved with re-meandering?
Well, the creek was in a ditch, so at some point the water was 6 feet down in this sluiceway, basically. So to remeander a creek, you get heavy machinery in there. There's an excavator, and the operator, this gentleman named Bob Harrison, was at the wheel, and he dug a new channel. So you literally dig the creek out of the ditch into a new meandering channel where the water is much closer to the surface, and it can flood naturally after storm events. And winds back and forth and forms a much, much more natural habitat for salmon and other stream creatures.
So if someone were to go out there today, how would it look different? I guess that's what's been accomplished in the 15 or so years you've been working on restoring it?
We're going on 15 years, and it's just amazing. We look at photos we took on those first visits out. We have to just pinch ourselves. So after the remeander, so the creek is no longer in the ditch and hasn't been, and it's been changing almost every winter and getting more and more natural looking. And then starting in the winter of 2005, there were groups of school children came up with their families from the neighborhood, from Port Townsend area, and eventually from the Quilcene and Chimicum school districts, and started tree planting. And those plantathons, as Northwest Watershed Institute has called them, have now reforested in essentially the entire watershed.
Wow.
And those trees are growing. We talked to kids who are in high school or going off to college who planted trees at our little place in 2005. And they go back and visit those trees now and just can't believe their eyes. They're 20, 30 feet tall and shading the creek and dropping organic material into the baby salmon eat. So it's been an absolute transformation.
Are you seeing a nice salmon run in there?
Yes. There are coho and chum salmon that were still in the creek. There were small populations left when Northwest Watershed Institute started this project. They've come back, and they go up and down every year the way salmon do, but the breeding habitat is much, much better. So the nesting success is much better than it had been for probably 50 to 80 years before this project started.
And over your period of 15 years, which is actually a really good, steady length of time, how often did you find that you changed your plans?
the plans kind of evolve. It's not as if we have a big overall idea. I guess the overall idea is just to make a better habitat and better forest or stream area. But I guess every year something different comes up and what we work on changes. So it's just sort of paying attention to what's going on and going from there.
Can you give me an example of one of those changes?
Our big project right now is one of the big changes. We had actually a wonderful thing happen after the remand was a few years old, is that beavers came back. And beavers
wow.
make fantastic, yes, it was dramatic. Beavers make fantastic salmon habitat because the juveniles, the babies, love to sit in the ponds behind the dam
uh-huh.
and find a lot to eat, and the water's nice and deep and cool. So we were delighted to have beavers back. They produced kits. They had a lodge on our place. But then when they moved on, after they run out of food and were going to move to a different part of the watershed, their dam broke. And so this acre pond that we had that we loved to visit and had all sorts of wildlife drained. And then we had a huge infestation of, a lot of your listeners will recognize, weed canary grass.
Oh, yeah.
Notorious.
Yeah.
Notorious invasive. And it gets 9 feet tall. Within a year, we know we had a big problem. So that was a major setback. And we've been working very hard with friends and other folks interested in the project to get that area reforested.
Yeah, I'll bet the sort of notion of invasives is a huge issue. In fact, I do have a quote from your book, which particularly struck me, and it's, quote, "Planting native species is a way to practice poetry, but controlling invasives is all about prose. The work makes you sweat. The thorns and prickles draw blood. Their persistence brings you to tears." And I thought, oh boy, you've been fighting invasives. You know that.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I have scratches on the back of my hand from blackberry right now.
Yeah, I'll bet. Sure. Yeah.
Some of your listeners are nodding and saying, yep.
Yep. I'm going, oh, I should be out doing that. Haven't been lately. But I want to ask a sort of broader question, too, which is, as you're doing this restoration project, are you thinking about potential impacts of climate change, sea level rise, and how does that affect how you think about your project?
I'd say two things with climate change. One is we can't control what's going out on the ocean. We've made the
sure.
breeding habitat better, as I mentioned, but folks in Jefferson County are probably aware of what oceanographers were calling the blob.
Yeah.
Which is this big pool of warm water that really depressed salmon populations all over the Northwest. And we saw our runs in Terrible Creek go down. That's a direct function of climate change. The other place where climate change really impacts this project and our friends and neighbors is just the practical matter of what trees are we going to put in the ground. You know, as Susan said, we change every year as we see the land change, and we see some species be successful and others not. So we're out there planting every year. And we have to think, are we planting for current weather conditions or what projections may be if we keep spewing as much carbon dioxide mm-hmm. and methane and other gases into the air? That's always a tough call. Is, are we trying to anticipate what the climate is going to be in 100 years or plant trees that can thrive right now?
And I guess we won't know whether we're thinking about it correctly or not, will we?
Ecologists are debating all over the world. It's really a conundrum, and no one knows what to do. We're running the experiment right now. Our personal philosophy is that we're putting in trees and shrubs that will thrive now with mm-hmm. the idea that as a community, as a global community, we're going to get organized and do something about climate change before storms and forest fires and sea level rise get even worse. So we're sort of betting on what Bill Gates Sr. likes to call the public will to rise up and solve this problem in an effective way.
Well, and then as Susan mentioned, this is sort of ongoing organic project, and you can hopefully have time to plant other species somewhere in the future.
That's
if
right.
If you need to. I've got another sort of big picture question to ask you. As wonderful as the work is that you're doing on Tarboot Creek, it is a really tiny drop compared to massive global issues, deforestation, stream degradation, and on and on. How do you answer the question, does your work make a difference?
I'd say part of the answer is spiritual and part of it is practical and physical.
The Give me both.
Part is when we look at the problems you just described, I don't want to curl up in a ball in the fetal position and just howl
mm-hmm.
and just scare. I want to act.
Yeah.
And this is our way to act. So that's spiritual response to a problem. And then the practical and physical part is I've written elsewhere, when we each do a little, we get a lot. And
mm-hmm.
I'm a great believer. It's like voting.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't do it, bad things can happen. And part of having this book come out and me researching for it and looking, it is absolutely astonishing and inspiring how many local efforts there are like this. For example, I was doing a radio show in Pennsylvania, and so I happened to look up projects. There are 53 land trusts in the state of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So we can get discouraged about what's going on nationally or internationally, but at a local level, small neighborhoods, communities are doing a lot of exciting things to make their part of the world a lot better. And this is international. It's not just mm-hmm. the U.S. by any means.
So it's that classic think globally but act locally.
Absolutely. We've said it so much it almost sounds trite, but when you actually start doing it, it works. So we're great believers in that stance.
Well, and I think the Jefferson Land Trust is also adding, and I don't know if it's original to the Land Trust or not, but also adding the next sentence of think forever, but act now.
Absolutely, the kind of state of mind you're in. Because the trees, I remind people who are out planting with us, we put a red cedar in the ground and come back a couple of years later and find it thriving. And I'll remind people, Western red cedars on the Olympic Peninsula could live over 1,000 years. You're planting something way beyond your great-grandchildren, even.
So I think I know the answer to my last couple of questions, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Will you continue doing this type of work? And will you close on what personal benefits you and your family have gotten from doing the work?
Well, I think the project for Scott and me, anyway, and our family will last until we can't move anymore, drop dead, or can't go and get out there. But I think it's just something that is just so meaningful for us that we'll continue doing it no matter what. I think that when people ask what was something that was surprising about this project, it's surprising to me that this is something that's not common for everyone. I mean, the fact of getting out there and working in the land, bringing our friends out there, has just been so surprising that people just love it, and they just get so much pleasure out of being out there and working together and thinking about what it will look like down the road. To me, that is something that is part of my core, and I think that's what drives us to do this, and I think that's what gives both of us so much inspiration to keep doing it. And it just being outside is just gives you that connection to another part of life that mm-hmm. you don't get when you're living in an urban area mm-hmm. or in a house. There's that deep spirituality or that deep sense of rightness, things that feel good, and we can use a lot of that.
It would be lovely to talk more with you, but I am going to need to close and thank both of you, Scott and Susan Freeman, and I'm going to restate the title of your book one more time, which is Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
So let's hear that mystery sound again. Those were the songs and calls of the violet-green swallow. It's a small, sleek bird found throughout western United States. According to the Cornell Ornithology Laboratory, violet-green swallows breed in open evergreen and deciduous woodlands, especially in woodlands with standing dead trees that feature woodpecker holes or other natural cavities. They breed across the western United States from sea level to as high as 11,500 feet in elevation. I've seen them in my Port Townsend yard, up in the Solduck River Valley, and out on the open coast. Identification clues from the Cornell Ornithology Lab state that on first look, violet-green swallows appear dark above and crisp white below. In good light, the greenish-bronze back and iridescent violet rump come to life. All individuals have white bellies that wrap around to the upper side of the rump. Those sort of create saddlebag-like things. Males have white cheek patches, while females and juveniles have dusky cheeks. Well, let's take a few minutes and look at upcoming events again with Charlie Fleischman.
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is offering a backyard birder class on migration on Saturday, May 5th at their Dungeness River Audubon Center. Tomas Setubal will lead a discussion on the incredible phenomenon of migration and the mechanisms that govern the mass movement of bird species. More information on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society webpage.
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is also organizing a Birdathon and World Migratory Bird Day count on May 12th. The goal of the day is to record and count every bird seen that day, and of course to have a good time doing it. There'll be a lot happening, including a pre-Birdathon field trip on May 5th. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website has all the details.
On the afternoon of Wednesday, May 9th, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center is providing training for those interested in becoming a volunteer for the Marine Mammal Stranding Network. Current members of the team are welcome to attend and refresh their knowledge. Check the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for more details.
And as a reminder, both the Natural History Exhibit and the Marine Aquarium are open now on spring hours. That would be Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays from noon to 5 p.m. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m., Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Knob Creek, played by the Steep Canyon Rangers.